As part of National Marriage Week this week, the theme is, what is the recipe for healthy relationships? The Marriage Foundation suggests that the key ingredients are friendship, kindness, commitment, forgiveness, intimacy, and communication. Emma Waring is a sex and relationships psychotherapist, and she's on Radio Gorgeous today to talk us through ideas about how to keep the sparkle and intimacy in relationships during the many years of marriage. Hi, Emma. A warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
So first of all, let's just briefly talk about marriage. Do you think it's still a good idea, marriage, for couples?
I do think it's a good idea, yes. And interestingly, I was at an event this week for Marriage Week, and somebody presented some data that said that a big research study had asked school children what they aspired to, some teenagers, and 80% of them said that they aspired to getting married and having children.
Well, that's wonderful. So that means that hopefully, you know, at least half of them will.
Yes. Yes. What I do think, though, is really important is that we look at how couples can be supported in marriage. Because, you know, there's a lot of excitement and run up to the big day itself. And then couples are just left to get on with it. And actually, marriage is hard work. Relationships are hard work. And I think that anything that we can do to support couples to look at what they need to help their marriage flourish is really important.
You're right, actually, because I'll never forget in my marriage service in the church, the vicar said, you know, and I didn't really understand what he was talking about at the time, but he said, you have to work at a marriage. And now, 25 and a half years later, I really know what he meant.
Well, I think what's interesting is that certainly the religious marriage vows, and I guess a lot of the marriage vows that are not religious as well, are all about hard work. It's about in the good times, the bad times. It's about when we're healthy, when we're sick, when we have money, when we don't have money, when we're rich, when we're poor. Actually woven into the marriage vows is a commitment that we will weather the storms with our spouse. And that's very challenging, I think.
But that's rather beautiful, because that's really, I mean, as we know, because we're at a, well, I'm a bit older than you, but it's like, you know, that people, you know, they may go through a divorce and then they try and find a man and the same problems come up. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's really is weathering the storm and both being very committed to try and make the relationship work. Don't you agree?
I do agree. And I'm biased because I'm a therapist. I have a background in nursing, but I've gone into working as a therapist. And actually, one of the things I think can be hugely helpful in marriage is for people to go through therapy, either as a couple or individually. And actually, one of the things I think that makes or really helps a relationship to flourish is really understanding ourselves, understanding our family upbringing, childhood experiences, the kind of voices that we were getting from our main caregivers, because they will shape how we are in adulthood. And we take a lot of baggage into our marriages. Some of that can be very good, and it's been reinforcing and positive messages we've had, but some of those experiences can be negative. And actually, if you get two sets of people coming together to share their life with rucksacks full of baggage, potentially there are going to be some difficulties. And to really understand yourself can be a really good starting point, I think, to go into a relationship. And sometimes therapy is part of that journey.
So you're talking not about sex therapy now, you're just talking about general therapy.
Yeah, so my career pathway has been interesting in terms of working out what I've needed along the way to help people. So I have a background in nursing. And I set up a clinic to help male cardiac patients with erectile dysfunction. And treating erectile dysfunction is relatively easy. There are lots of good treatments out there. But what I found as I was working in this service was that actually I was meeting men on their own, often, sometimes couples, where their marriages or their relationships were really on the brink of breaking down. or in many cases actually had broken down, and I felt really ill-equipped. So what I did was I went and did a two-year training to become a psychosexual therapist. What's really interesting is some years on, 10 years on from qualifying, I've realised that actually I also needed a qualification in more general therapy, because sometimes people come through the door with a sexual problem, erectile dysfunction, sexual pain, ejaculatory issues, or a number of physical things. But actually, when I get to meet them and I understand them as a person, I realise that there are much broader issues going on for them. So maybe...
What sort of things? Can you kind of just give us a few ideas?
Yeah, so things like anxiety. Mm-hmm. So somebody might come in and they might have what we call performance anxiety erectile dysfunction. So it's psychogenic. So we know that there isn't a physical underlying physical blood flow problem, but actually when they're with their partner, with their spouse, they get anxious. They might not think they are, but they're getting anxious and they're losing their erection. We know that it's likely to be psychological if there are some situations where they can get and keep a good erection. So, for example, if they're on their own and they're masturbating and they say, yep, my erection's really good, and then they're with their partner and they lose their erection, that is a really good clue to us that actually it's much more likely to be a psychological issue. But when I meet men like that, often when I ask them about how they function in the world generally, putting aside the sexual issue, they'll often say, actually, anxiety is not an issue that's isolated to just my sex life. Actually, I really struggle with anxiety at work, or I really struggle with anxiety in the way that I relate to friends or family or what have you. So it's interesting that there are themes that come out.
So it makes sense. It's like they've sort of separated their problem into the sex thing, but actually it's a general problem, isn't it? Which a man hasn't wanted to face.
Exactly. And so what I realised a couple of years ago was that it would be really helpful to have a broader training in general therapy so that I could work with a wider range of issues, be it anxiety, maybe depression, maybe issues to do with really struggling with emotional intimacy. Or so, for example, I might have somebody who is going through a succession of relationships, and actually what they want is they want to get married. But they've grown up in a family perhaps where emotions were suppressed. They're not used to being emotionally intimate, and so it proves difficult for them in relationships to sustain something for any length of time. They might be able to do the sexual side of things, but actually they're struggling with the emotional side. So it's been, this journey for me has been an eye-opener in terms of what's needed to be able to fully work with couples, because you're never, or individuals, you're never quite sure that the issue that's brought them through the door is actually the issue. It could be something else. It could be sexual trauma, childhood sexual abuse, infidelity, addiction, all number of things, really.
And yeah, and I suppose a lot of people are in denial. I mean, they come in and they don't, it's sort of unconscious, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm interested in Radio Gorgeous because we're a podcast for women. What problems do women particularly have that you've come across, you know, in the last few years?
So it's interesting. I would say that probably about 70% of the patients I'm seeing at the moment are women. And that's been a bit of a shift because typically I've worked more with men. But the three problems that I see in women are something called dyspareunia, which is the medical term for sexual pain. Then I work with a condition called vaginismus, which is an involuntary spasm of the vaginal muscle that makes penetration impossible or certainly very difficult.
And I
usually see women in that context that are wanting to have a baby and have often never actually been able to have penetrative intercourse. The other issue that I see is low libido, so a low desire to want to be sexual. So those are the three main things.
So can we talk through them, please?
So dyspareunia, sexual pain, often falls into sort of two camps, really. And whenever I see a woman, I'm fortunate because I'm based in a hospital clinic. So usually the women that come to see me have been referred by their GP or a gynecologist or a urologist. So usually I've got quite an extensive medical letter that will say, anatomically, we've examined this lady, everything is fine. So that's really important, first of all, to rule out, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to invest lots of time going to see a sex therapist or indeed a therapist to talk about these issues, only to find out you've got chronic thrush or recurrent urinary tract infections.
Yes.
Or a skin condition like lichen sclerosis that can make sex painful. So it's really, really important to rule out that you've got any sort of physical cause for the pain. So if somebody came to see me and they hadn't come through a medical route, I would, I don't do physical examinations myself, and I would say, I think you need to go back to your gynecologist or your GP and just make sure that anatomically, physically, there's nothing that's really glaringly obvious that is likely to be causing you sexual pain.
So what is sexual pain? Can you just tell us?
Well, it can vary. So some women describe pain in the vulval area. So you have something called vulvodynia, and that can be provoked or unprovoked.
And the vulva is sort of around the vagina.
Is the bit that we can see.
Yeah.
So if I was to lie down and open my legs and hold a mirror and look down in the mirror, it's difficult to see because it's underneath your body, unlike a man where you can see their genitals. But if I was to look in the mirror, and I often get women to do this at home as an exercise, that the vulval area is the area that you can see, and you have the labia minora and the labia majora. So they're like the lips of the vulva, the inner and the outer, and they vary a lot. If I've got a great book which is called The Great Wall of Vagina, and it's a piece of artwork that a Brighton-based artist did, where he got plaster casts of different 400 women's vulval areas.
Wow.
And he made it into a piece of artwork which has travelled around the world. But you can buy a book of it, and I use that sometimes with my clients to show them how different our vulval areas are. And one of the things that's difficult for women is we don't really see other women's private parts or vulval areas.
No.
Because
you're a midwife or something.
Yeah, unless you're a midwife. And of course I did as a nurse. But that's unusual. Most of us, we don't see other women's vulval areas. And so it can be a bit confusing. You know, am I normal? One side looks a bit longer than the other. Perhaps the inner labia minora hang lower than the majora. So it can be confusing for women. Is this normal? Indeed, I've worked with women that have wanted to have surgery in that area, and we've talked about why and their ideas that perhaps that they're abnormal, when of course they're not, because there's such a variation.
Fantastic. That sounds really good. Positive.
So you can get pain in the vulval area. You can get pain further into the vagina. You only have nerve endings in the first third of the vagina, so you getting pain further up tends to be unusual. Some sexual positions can cause discomfort, but that's normal. But this is talking about the entrance to the vagina.
So what brings on this pain? I mean,
well, it can be things like chronic thrush, and some women don't know that they've got thrush, so that's why it's really important that that you're seen by a doctor who can take some swabs and do an examination and just rule out that you haven't got something like bacterial vaginosis or chronic thrush, or urinary tract infections can be very painful. And can make pain very uncomfortable.
So that's things like cystitis or...
That's right, yeah.
Or I had one that, yeah, where it went up to my kidneys. That was agony. I think that's the most agonising things I've ever had.
Yeah, it is. It's to have a kidney infection is excruciatingly painful.
Yeah.
So you can have eczema, you can have skin conditions where the tissue down there becomes very sore.
It's amazing you just don't think of these things until you have them, and then it must be very frightening for someone because it is such a private part that as you say, we don't understand it.
Yes, and we're unlikely to talk about it, and we don't really look at that part of our body unless we get a mirror and we're intentional about doing it. We often don't look at at this part of our body, so we don't really know what it looks like, and we can't compare, is it redder this week, now it's sore, you know, because we don't regularly look at it unless we get a mirror and do that. So some women will have sexual pain and we can attribute it to a cause. But a lot of the women that I work with are having sexual pain because they're not sexually aroused when they are trying to have intercourse.
Okay. So they're not warmed up enough. Do you think that's the problem?
That's right.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know this, but when a man has an erection, he has 8 times more blood that flows into his penis to give him an erection than he does when his penis is flaccid. And that process also happens in a woman. So when a woman is aroused, she has what we call vaginal engorgement, and the whole vulval area gets engorged with blood, and it's almost like it pads itself out, ready for something to go into the vagina.
So interesting.
And as many of us women will know, when we go and have a smear test, it's often not really painful, but it's uncomfortable because something is being put into the vagina, and our body's not prepared for that.
Mm.
And we can tolerate it for a smear because we don't have to, you know, we're not doing that every week. It's something that we just have very occasionally. But there are some women that are attempting to have intercourse who are finding it really difficult to get aroused, and then their partner, their spouse, is trying to put his penis inside a dry vagina that's not ready, and it's really uncomfortable and can be extremely painful. So some of the work that I do is helping women to understand that actually to get aroused can take quite a long time. And one of the difficulties is, I mentioned performance anxiety, erectile dysfunction. Women have performance anxiety in the bedroom as well. Mm. You know, this sense of, I must get turned on, I must be aroused, I must enjoy this. And of course, as soon as you stop having those thoughts, the very opposite thing happens. You don't enjoy it. You get preoccupied with the fact that you're not getting turned on and you need to get turned on, and you get stressed about it. Mm. And then it's a vicious cycle, which is quite difficult to break. So that's the other group of women that I tend to work with.
So how do you suggest getting turned on then?
Yeah, so...
you know, what sort of ideas do you have?
So I think even before you get to the bedroom, it's quite helpful to understand the different ways in which men and women function sexually. So... In the 1960s, when Masters and Johnsons, who were kind of the founders of sex therapy, they did a lot of research, and they said what happens in men and women is that you have spontaneous sexual desire, which comes out of nowhere. You then have a sex drive, so you actually act on your desire. You then do things with your partner that get you aroused. You then have a plateau phase of being aroused. The peak of that is usually orgasm, and then you have a resolution phase where your body returns to a normal state. And for many years, we believe this is how men and women function sexually. And then a researcher in the 80s called Rosemary Basson did some wide reaching research, and she said, looking at women, and she said, I don't think that women respond in the way that men do. I think women have a lot less spontaneous sexual desire. And rather than moving through this sort of linear model, she did a circular model. And she said, there are two things that are really important for women when it comes to sex. The first one is they have to feel good about their relationship. If there's a lot of relationship disharmony, if they don't feel safe with their partner, then if there's not much goodwill in the relationship, then they are not likely to want to feel like being intimate physically. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing she said was, unlike men who have spontaneous desire, us women are often in neutral. It's not that we don't want to have sex, but equally we're not thinking about sex.
No, not all the time, like men generally.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So she said that in order to tip the balance from neutral to positive, women need to get aroused first, which is a bit of a back-to-front model to the man. So she says that it's really important that that women are doing things to get aroused, because then, unlike the man where this comes first, desire then kicks in and she wants to continue what she's doing. So in answer to your question, one of the two key things that I recommend to women are using lots of vaginal lubricants. We can often think, oh, it's just menopausal women that need vaginal lubricant. It's not. I advise couples of all ages to have lubricant by their bed or wherever they're having intimacy, and to apply it, because it's much nicer for the vulval area to be touched by the woman herself or indeed her partner if it's slippery, rather than if he's trying to rub her clitoris, for example, or touch her vulva or put his fingers inside the vagina and it's dry. So that's the first
thing. So it's sort of preparing it for enjoyment, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So you're anticipating it. And usually the woman, when she starts to get aroused, will produce her own vaginal lubricant. That changes a bit in menopausal women, but usually the body will kickstart its own production of lubricant, but it's good to start that process. The other thing that I think is can be really helpful for women if they are stuck in this cycle of, I'm not getting aroused, I know I need to get aroused, is to get a vibrator. And there are so many fantastic vibrators available. They are, many of them are designed by women. So a lot of women will say to me, well, I don't mind getting a vibrator, but I don't want something that looks like a penis. It really puts me off.
Yeah.
And actually, you can get a wide range of vibrators that I could even have on my sitting on my desk, and somebody would just think they were it was a nice pen holder or a perfume atomizer. You know, it's they don't look phallic.
Oh, amazing.
They're nice and small. And they can be brilliant to use for clitoral stimulation. Only about, it's estimated that only about 25% of women will orgasm through penetrative intercourse.
Yes, I never have.
Yeah, most women will experience their orgasm through clitoral stimulation. So what's so fantastic about using a vibrator is you can lie with your partner, and rather than him or her desperately trying to arouse you, you getting stuck in this cycle, you can use a vibrator. Often the clitoris will immediately respond to that and you will feel aroused. And then what's great is your body's responding and feeling aroused, and then you have the desire. You move from neutral to positive. You then have the desire to do more stuff.
It's such good advice. I love it. So you can sort of together really have fun with the lube and the vibrator, get you in the mood, and then it sort of all starts kicking in naturally.
Yeah. And one thing that one example that I often use with couples I work with that I think demonstrates the difference between men and women quite nicely is I give them two scenarios to help them understand the Rosemary Basson model of female arousal. So I say, let's imagine that you both come in from work and you're busy, you're sorting out the kids, your husband comes in from work, he sits down and eats his meal in front of, or you both sit down and eat your meal in front of the TV, don't have a huge amount of chat, you've got a million things to do to get ready for the morning, You do the packed lunches, you've got to put some clothes in the washing machine. You're worried because you've got a meeting the next morning and it's playing on your mind and you don't feel ever so prepared, but you're trying to get everything done. And then you fall into bed at 11 o'clock, having not really had much communication with your husband, and you kiss him goodnight, you're desperate for sleep, you turn to go to sleep and he snuggles up to you, and you sense that he's interested in having sex.
Yes.
And you turn to him and say, "You've got to be joking. Do you have any idea how tired I am? Do you have any idea what I've got on in the morning? I'm exhausted." And you're angry that he's even thinking about it. You turn away from him. He's angry that you're not interested and feels rejected. He turns away. You go to bed, you wake up, the morning you're a bit scratchy with each other. So that's one example. Example number two, which is thinking about what Rosemary Basson said in terms of feeling good about your relationship. You both come home from work, you're tired, you've got lots on. You don't have your dinner in front of the telly, you have it opposite each other and you talk. And he says, "How's your day?" And you say, "My day's not been great. I've got loads of things to do to get ready for the morning. And also, I'm quite stressed. I've got a meeting at work tomorrow and it's going to be difficult." And he says, "Tell me about it." So you say, "Well, I've got this, I've got that." And you have a chat with him about it. And then he says to you, "Is there anything I can do that would help you for the morning?" And you say, "Do you know what? Could you just make the kids pack lunches? I'm going to go upstairs, just have half an hour to prepare for this meeting." So you do that and then you get into bed. You're still in neutral at this point. And you kiss him goodnight and you turn over to go to sleep and he snuggles up to you. And then what he does is he touches your breast. Now, you feel really good towards him. He's listened to you. He understands that you're stressed. He's helped you out. You've had stuff to do and he's been really helpful. He touches your breast, which feels quite nice. You move from neutral to positive and then you make love and you go to sleep and the morning is very different. Mm. It's the subtlety of how we connect with our partner,
mm-hmm,
that will often influence whether we want to be sexual with them.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so many couples have said that understanding that is really helpful for them. And also the woman has said, "Remembering that I'm often in neutral and that when he touches me, that will be the thing that will often then push me into positive and then sexual desire will kick in for the woman."
It's fantastic. It's just so brilliant, everything you're saying. I think we've touched so much now that I don't think we're going to go into the other two problems, because I think if anyone has one of those serious problems, they can always contact you or a sex therapist. But I've so enjoyed having you on Radio Gorgeous today. Your advice is fantastic. How can we find these wonderful men that will be helpful?
I think that they need to realise it's in their own interests.
Yes, exactly. If men realise that they're going to get something at the end of it.
and actually to remember that, it's teamwork, isn't it?
Yes.
So much of life, that's what we sign up to when we get married, to be a partnership. And what's so interesting is that if you think about couples on their wedding day and the vows they're making and the commitments they're making, if you went up to any couple and said, "Do you realize that in 2 or 3 years' time you won't have had sex for 6 months they wouldn't be able to believe it or contemplate it. And yet that's what happens to so many couples. So we have to think about what changes. We have to preempt those, and we have to think that we need to really pull together as a team and also be really intentional about sexual intimacy. We have to remember that after the first few years of a marriage, often sex won't be spontaneous. It's not like the films where you're ripping each other's clothes off. You've got busy jobs and children and mortgages and all sorts of things to do, and sex falls to the bottom of the list. So you have to really talk as a couple about how do we make sure that we are intentional about this aspect of our relationship, because we know that sexual intimacy is so important in relationships. It energizes the bond between a husband and wife, or between partners. And it really helps with emotional intimacy as well. So we have to just really commit to being intentional and talking about how we're going to do these things.
And people talk about, you know, having dates for this, dates for that. So have sex dates. There's nothing wrong with it, is there?
Well, I think, you know, date nights can sound a bit naff, but actually I think they really, really work. I think that, you know, we all lead very busy lives, and actually it's really nice to know that our partner is prioritising spending time with us. And I often say to couples, do you know what, if you're having a nice evening together, why don't you consciously make an agreement that at the end of that evening you will have some sexual intimacy? And you, I think it's also really important to remember that sexual intimacy doesn't have to always include penetrative intercourse. There are plenty of reasons why a couple might not want to or might not be able to engage in penetration for a period of time following the birth of a baby, if a man's being treated for prostate cancer, if a woman's being treated for breast cancer, all these things that are very, very common. But actually to think about how can we still enjoy intimacy. And if
what do you count as intimacy, Emma?
So I think that I would count mutual masturbation, mm-hmm. and oral sex, sensual massage, kissing, lying together without clothes on, and
even doing something like having a bath together or getting in the shower together.
A bath together. Anything that you do with your partner that only the two of you would do together.
which makes
your relationship unique and special. And sometimes I say to people, look, if there is a reason, for example, you've just given birth to a baby, you know, you're not feeling sexual, or you know, you're recovering and your body's sore, whatever, I like the idea that one person can give a sexual act as a gift to their partner. So let's assume you've got a couple there in bed. They had a baby a month ago. The husband wants to have intimacy. I think that the couple can negotiate, and the woman can say, look, I'm really not in that space yet. I'm just getting used to changing in my body. I'm breastfeeding, you know, my vagina's still sore. But rather than him feeling rejected and going off to the bathroom and masturbating on his own or looking at pornography on his own, I think it's really good if the couple can talk about what their varying needs are. So in a given situation, the need for that woman at that point might be not to be required to be sexual, but recognise that her husband is missing that aspect of the relationship and say, would you like me to touch you? And then she can masturbate him using her hand, or she could give him oral sex if she was comfortable doing that, or he might masturbate himself with her lying next to him. That can be called intimate masturbation. So one person is stimulating and arousing themselves, but in the presence of their partner. And that can be very good for couples. It can be a good way of keeping intimacy going without the need for both people to be required to be sexual at a given time when that might be difficult.
Because that's really good, because that's not making sex into a sort of a bad thing, like I've got to go off and do it secretly. You know, it makes it a much more like, this is what we do together, even if you're not capable at the moment, darling.
Yeah. and I've worked with, you know, a number of patients where the man's had prostate cancer and he's struggling with erection issues, or the woman's had breast cancer and she's getting used to changes in her body. Maybe she's gone through chemotherapy and, you know, any sort of penetration during that time might be really painful for her. What you don't want is you don't want couples having secret sex lives on their own. That's actually very corrosive. And I work with couples that may not have had sexual intimacy together for years. And actually, when I see them together to start with, and then I will always have a session with them individually. And, you know, it's amazing that they will often be you know, be fulfilling their own sexual needs, but on their own. And I think how sad, because actually what that's doing is it's driving a wedge between them. And there's an element of secrecy that they're not sharing this aspect with their partner. And I think that if we can put aside our preconceived ideas about what we think sex should include and go be a little bit more open-minded, then we can do things like intimate masturbation, which is a brilliant way. I'm not suggesting people do it forever or that's all they ever do, but it can be a great sort of transitional thing to do as you're moving through stages of life where one person may be struggling a bit with sexual intimacy for themselves.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and telling us so many interesting things that we can go and do now.
Oh, thank you. Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah.
It's something that I think might be really helpful for listeners to understand.
Yeah.
There is a condition which I referenced earlier called vaginismus, which is an involuntary spasm of the vaginal muscle. And I very regularly see couples that have got married, but they've never consummated their marriage because of this condition.
How terrible.
And they come and see me because they want to have a baby, but they've never actually had sex. There are things that women can do. So there are vaginal dilators that women can buy and use. I've recently published a book called Seasons of Sex and Intimacy, and there's a whole chapter, self-help chapter, for couples to follow through steps to enable them to get to a stage where they can have penetration. But it is a condition that's rarely talked about, is very, very isolating for couples because there's an expectation they're going to start having children and nobody actually knows that they haven't even had sex yet.
Terrible. Poor, poor people. But it's
yeah.
Fantastic if you can help them. So if people want to get in touch with you, they go to emmawaring.com, Emma, WARING.com. There will be more information on our website. Thank you so much for your time and advice today. It's so appreciated.
Thank you.
And for more amazing women, you can always go to Radio Gorgeous. Thanks for listening.